Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of Robots and Red Tape. I am your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Dr. Dolores Cucina Messina here with me today. Dolores, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, it's another day in paradise. Thanks so much for asking. Been an interesting couple of weeks in our industry, as we were talking about before we started. But if you don't mind, for all the everybody that doesn't have the honor of knowing you yet, you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, hi everyone. I am the contracts acquisition nerd that you will find on LinkedIn that reads all the boring stuff. So I am the CEO of Rixada Solutions. Started that about 3 years ago with the vision of setting the record straight when it comes to acquisition. And really where that came from. So I started originally on commercial contracts and I wanted to do government contracts, which I know is unique. Most people fall into the job, they don't ask for it. And then I, got into the adventure of starting my PhD and really dove into innovation policy and found that there's such a much bigger world when it comes to acquisition outside of just the federal acquisition regulations. And what I knew of government contracts that was really popular where I lived, which was the shipbuilding industry. Construction and shipbuilding is a whole other world. But I didn't realize that there was even more to acquisition outside of, what was the comfort level that I had. And so that combined with me, making a big jump and deciding to do this on my own, I get to take on projects that I really enjoy. So I wrote my entire dissertation on other transaction authorities. So one of the, I think, three people that have a dissertation that talks about it. And one of the only, I think one of two people, which is my co-researcher, Ben McMartin, that has done a comparative study of all federal statutes of other transactions. So as you can see, I pick a topic, I dive really deep into it, I want to know as much about it. And I enjoy it. And now I'm really focused on international innovation policy and acquisition. So broadening the scope as much as I can.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, no, fascinating, fantastic. I appreciate that. I appreciate you coming on. It has to be with kind of the last couple of years and the increased activity relating to the AI space. It has to have been a fascinating time for you and also very busy.
Yes. Not just from a perspective of how do we get this into the right hands, how do we use it, but also how do we protect academic research? How does our intellectual property train of thought work now that we have these models that are open to a lot of folks? I mean, AI has been in our lives for a very long time. It just hasn't had, I think, the same I'm going to say sex appeal that it's had in the last like 2 years, right? When ChatGPT came out and everyone lost their mind. And it seems like the moment there's a new chatbot or there's a new platform available, that's all anyone will talk about for a week and a half. And what we saw with DeepSeek is that now it's starting to affect how businesses are operating and their revenue and what that means for the future of technology and technology firms. So it's really taken over the conversation and it's bleeding its way into almost every app you have and every conversation you have.
Absolutely. Probably in addition to that, a lot of papers that are coming out now have been researched with AI assistance or written with AI assistance. And so when you start really thinking about it, it absolutely is everywhere, and it's going to continue to expand. So in your area of expertise, speaking about the government, what are the ways that the government, acquires emerging technologies? Because I would assume it's different than some of the more like rote commodities out there, like routers, switches, what have you, cloud storage. I would assume this is different. How do they engage in this area?
So I think from what I've seen, at least, is I would say maybe like a year and a half ago, a lot of it was more developmental. More of it is now becoming because the commercial industry has really gotten it to a really good place where they think that it could be really easy for the government to just implement it the way that it is. So they're using a lot of FAR Part 12 or Federal Acquisition Regulations Part 12, or simplified acquisitions or FAR Part 13. They're able to leverage that in order for them to get already developed technologies into the hands of the government. But what we're finding is that there's a lot more security requirements. There's a lot more questions being asked about how this data is being used. There's a lot more questions about what data these organizations are using to build their models. There was a big case with Microsoft not too long ago about what they were using in order for them to build. Actually, Zoom in their privacy policy popped up not too long ago about how they can use any content in your videos for their training, for their AI models. And Zoom actually changed their entire model from being this to being now AI, which is kind of interesting in the way that it's moving along. And we also saw that OpenAI came out with a government side of things as well. So you can see now that I think there's going to be an AI commercial branch and there's going to be an AI government because it's going to cost companies a lot. The other way that I've seen the government buy it is through grants, co-op agreements, other transactions. The CBRSR program has been leveraged a lot, again, a lot for developmental work to get it to commercialization. But with very specific use cases, I think we as consumers tend to think of AI as just like generative AI. I plug in, create an itinerary for me for my trip to Argentina in May. And it makes your life easier that way. But to your point, people are using it for research. People are using it sometimes to help drive some big decisions like, hey, I want to research this policy. What is this AI going to tell me about it? And one of my fun times is to prove the AI wrong. So it was very easy to do it with other transaction authorities just because I know so much about them. And it was evident to see that a lot of them were referencing just the Department of Defense. So it's the government, I think, is taking a much more closer approach to how they're going to implement AI and for good reasons, especially because they're trying to implement it in operations, especially in defense. And so there's a rise of that. And looking internationally, the EU has really been focused on creating some standard safeguards commercially and with the government, which has been great. I know the US is trying to follow. So we'll see what happens in the next year about that, or how AI is going to play a pivotal role with the current administration and what they're trying to do to advance and modernize.
Absolutely. On the EU front, I was actually at an event earlier this week at the French embassy where they had a panel with the French ambassador and a couple other people and actually I think it was Microsoft's head of government affairs or government relations was there as well, talking a lot about about the EU's AI Act and how that's being implemented and how when you look at laws and things rolling out in the country, right? California tends to be the one of the strictest states as far as legislating things and legislation is concerned and putting rules in place and how because there's so many people there, everything kind of just has to fall in line. And some folks were saying that they think that actually may be the case globally as it relates to AI policy because EU is such a big market, nobody wants to miss out on that. And so a lot of what's going on there will end up driving driving policy elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think it'll also drive the market. Usually, where you have more safeguards, companies will just put that across the board because it's easier to manage. And EU actually, what they have as their safeguards, it's not, in my opinion, I don't think it's anything that's restrictive. I think it the way that they've framed it and the way that they're using it. Is really just to make sure that AI doesn't get abused, and make sure that the I would say like the society doesn't get harmed from AI. And we've all seen the movies. We all see when AI takes over and what happens. And I don't think we're, I don't, I think we're still far away from those types of movie situations. But when it comes to like facial recognition, things like that, you know, if we're looking at where we are with that, we're very far from being great at doing it. And but there's a lot of use. And I think EU's addressing how to make sure that we're doing that ethically, and we're doing that also with a human element involved to make sure that the machine doesn't make a bad decision.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I think some of the common sense policies are ensuring that there's a human in the loop as it relates to decision making and things like that. Transparency and visibility into not just why an AI system said what it said or did what it did, but also understanding of the underlying, understanding the data that, the training data that was used to train and build the system, and understanding where that comes from, as well, I think is super important. On government side, so the really there's three or four main ways that the government is engaging in the emerging technology space. One is, more routine FAR-based contracts, federal acquisition regulation contracts that are under, you said, parts 12 and 13. There's the OTA or other transaction authorities, which is a government, which is a way a government can engage and buy things without going through the without the FAR being involved, correct? And that, I mean, I know there's more to it, and I'd like to hear. I'm super simplifying it. I understand. I don't have a PhD in it, and I'm just trying to make it idiot proof over here for me, right? So, and then. Then they have SBIR, which is a small business innovation research, and CITR, which is, I think it's technology. I don't remember what the T stands for.
Technology transfer,
And then which are structured programs with a like a phase one for initial R&D, phase two for I think expanding, and then phase three is implementation.
Commercialization,
Commercialization. And so multiple parts that run through that. And are those the main ways that they acquire and engage with emerging tech at this point?
At this point, yes, I would say also I would just add on there, Kratos have become really popular as well. And Kratos, just to, so everybody knows, there's no money involved in a Kratos. What it is you get access to data. And so the government has gotten very smart over the last year and realized that they really need to test to make sure these things work in their environment before they spend a lot of money, which is great. That means that we're starting to learn how to buy software. So for Kratos, what's the benefit to a lot of small businesses, medium businesses, or anyone creating this tech is you get to use government data to test it, and you have a more of like a partnership with the government. That actually leads you to really good opportunities because you can say, hey, we have the ability to use this type of data, play with it. It's usually very, I would say it's a very small piece of data, and you generally will partner with a university. But if you're just trying to get your foot in the door and someone offers you that, like that's an amazing opportunity. I would just add that on there as like just the ding.
The government has a lot of data, and whether it's, in a lot of different areas, whether it's, defense, defense and the IC community and the data, all the data that they have, or, you look at like HHS or CMS specifically and all the medical data, or you look at, a place like NIH under HHS again and all the research data, or NASA and all of their data, both, here, research data, but also, in the universe as well. And so yeah, huge amounts of data. So that's fantastic. And what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've seen in just industry versus industry versus the reality?
So I would say the first one, and it's a big one, is that a lot of people have the misconception that the government knows how to buy commercial technology or that they know how to buy software. From the way that the federal acquisition regulations were written, they were not necessarily written to buy software. If you really read it, it wasn't set up that way. Now, We've
What was
made
it
some
set up by?
adjustments to it.
What was it set up to by?
It was to essentially buy like commodities, to buy more of like solidified products, not necessarily to buy like services or develop like or to buy like licenses. Because it so the FAR was established in the 1980s. We didn't have these types of software models we have today back then. And the government has adjusted for that, right? To say, hey, we need to bring in more commercial technologies. We need to have these policies. So the FAR was revised. There were, went through the Federal Register. We have commercial product services distinction now. We have simplified acquisition that has been increased in order for us to be able to use faster procedures. We have for a lot of agencies now, they have the other transaction authority, which helps a lot, which helps address people not entering the market. But I think the idea that the government understands a lot of these practices is a big misconception companies go in because they go in with the speak that they're used to using and not understanding that that's not necessarily translatable on the government side. And again, we saw this with AI. I think when you and I first met, we talked a little bit about this. I had a fun game reading solicitations for AI, and I found that a lot of times what they were saying was AI was actually just automation in, in a database, not necessarily adding an element of any artificial intelligence. To simplify it, it was almost like running a macro in your Excel workbook to get a quick answer, but there wasn't an actual intelligence piece to it. It was just coding. So you have to understand that there the people that are writing the requirements, goes through a very long process. And so this misconception that the requirements that are in that solicitation or on that draft RFP are coming from experts that really know. And I think industry comes in reading it, thinking, oh, okay, this is what you want. They try to fit into it instead of working with the government and saying, hey, you're actually missing the ball on this. This isn't the way that you would set this up. This is how the current system works. These are the this is the equipment that you're going to need. These are the type of people. We also saw this with pricing out AI folks for research, where labor categories were getting questioned. You're not going to have someone with 40 years of experience in AI that's going to be willing to take a salary of $75,000. It's not going to happen. But that was a big topic, I think, about a year ago in terms of what we saw was being rejected in pricing for a lot of these firms that were providing the services. So that would be the big misconception is that the government knows. They don't. That's why they're looking at industry. And you see in a lot of solicitations now where they say they want to leverage commercial experience and knowledge because they're recognizing they have some catching up to do.
Absolutely,
I
they
would
do.
say the second big misconception is that you have to have a specific award instrument for what you want to do, meaning, how many times have you heard, Nick, for people being like, I want a CBER. That's all I want. If I just had a CBER, I would be able to make it. It happens all the time, right? Someone's like, oh, I just want a CBER. And it's like, why? Why do you want this? What are you trying to do? And it's because they hear that that's the best way for them to go forth. The FAR and our US code is written to be flexible in order for us to leverage it for what we need to. And so it comes down to the question that everybody loves to hear from their contracts manager, which is, it depends. Because it does. It depends on what you're trying to do. And so, to your point, if you're trying to do research, trying to do developmental work, you might not need a FAR-based agreement. Maybe you're looking at a grant. Maybe you need to fund something for that development. Maybe you're looking just to see if your idea is feasible. So then you would go into like a phase one or research and development OT. You might even get a purchase order or a proof of concept type of agreement where, or a letter of contract, something short term that you can just talk to the government in order for you to see is this a feasible idea. Go to a prize challenge, right? Maybe you need to first meet with government folks and understand how they speak. And so I think this misconception that you need like the
Mm-hmm.
secret contract or agreement in order for you to make it is the second biggest one.
Yeah, so it sounds like those are really under the same thing, which is just lack of knowledge on both sides. Which is absolutely something that we identify, I see, and I have identified. And also, I don't think that industry should absolutely know always what government it does and how they engage, especially folks that are not, let's just say, in the bubble that we live in, as far as it relates to most of the people that I work with understand, or I know understand, because that's who we deal with. So I think that like there's that, but also I think the government should, like, I don't think it's the government should not, like, everybody should not know enough about every single topic that the government is buying to be an expert, right? They should have experts involved in the process, whether that's from an end, if you're developing or rolling out a new system, you absolutely need to have both the users and then, on both sides. So the users that are like the end users and then like the technical users who are going to administer the system, they all need to be involved, but they should not know how to build it themselves, because if they did, then, they wouldn't need to contract it out.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's again, like, what are you trying to do? Are you asking for someone to solve the problem for you, or are you trying to buy a very specific thing, right? And this is where we kind of get into, I think, really the nitty-gritty part of the contract and how you're going to structure it. If you know what you're going to buy and you know exactly what it is, then just say it. Just say, I want to buy 17 Microsoft Office 365 licenses. Great, that's what you're going to get. If you write your solicitation and say, I have a problem. I need some kind of technology to help me identify threats, be able to recommend me, some decision points, and then provide me a recommended solution based on those decision points. And then I can enter my fact knowledge and get a different solution. Then you're going to have a very wide range of technologies coming forth and telling you what they can offer you to solve the problem. But if you're going in with that preconceived notion of like, well, I didn't really want that. Then why did you write your requirements that way? And to your point, it's also a little bit, I think, not just lack of knowledge, but I would say also a lack of clear communication of need. And I think it's also because they're trying to protect, right, what they really want in some instances. But you've got to say it because otherwise your acquisition plan goes out the window. If you don't have that information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, so understanding that there's a lot of people out there that do believe that, like, they just need a SIBR and they'll make it. Who should be engaging in the SIBR program, and who, as say I'm a commercial company, right? Or I'm a startup and I have this idea. What are the decision points I should be looking at to go for the FAR based versus an OTA versus, a SIBR sitter, or into one of the marketplaces that I know you've mentioned as well? Kind of how, what should I be thinking about?
So the first thing I think you should be thinking about is where are you currently with the development of your technology? So if you're in the very early stages, that'll tell you that you're probably not going to be looking for things or opportunities that are looking for an already commercialized product that are where you can leverage like FAR Part 12. They're not looking for something that is a final or program of record, as some agencies will use. You're looking for something like price challenges. You're probably looking for a SIBR to do a proof of concept. You're probably looking for a research and development, other transaction, maybe a prototype, depending on where you are. The way you would know is really, there's a scale. The government likes to use the technology readiness levels because it's a model that's existed for a very long time. It's a scale from 1 to 9. Think of one as an idea, you drew it on a napkin, you think it's going to happen, but now you need to test it. 9 is it's fully deployed, meaning someone's using it, you're selling it, you're successful, and then all the stages in between. And if you look at that scale, you can kind of also match up what are some of the authorities you can use along the way. Where it gets a little bit tricky is when you're starting to develop alternatives to that solution, where it could be considered developmental, but we'll keep it simple for
Please.
this morning,
If
just so we
anybody
don't
wants to get more complex, you can reach out to her directly.
Yes, exactly. So I would say people that are looking for a SIBR are going to be small companies that are trying to get their idea to the commercial market. That should not be your only pathway. And I say this to everybody, do not think that you should only target one just because it's a good fit. At the same time, you should be looking at other opportunities. Look at investors, look at venture capital, look at angel investors, look at bank loans. Because the government takes a long time. They are not quick with it. So you have to make sure that you're planning out for 2 years to potentially win an award, because it's very hard for you just to get lucky the first time anyway. So these are the small businesses that are going to go for that phase one. They're going to be the same companies that go for a potential prize challenge. They're going to be the same ones that are going to want to work with a partnership intermediary potentially. Companies that have really great relationships with universities and colleges would probably go for a sitter. And the reason for that is the small business still gets to keep all the rights to what the end product is, but they get to leverage the resources of the university in order for them to work together. The advantage of that is you have PhDs and you have experts at that university and data that you can leverage and you can work together. So that's the only difference between a SIBR and a sitter, is that in one hand you have a university involved, in the other one you don't. And the way the Small Business Administration defines that is research institute. So as long as they're fit within the definition of research institute, usually they're not defined in the solicitation, you can leverage them. So just be aware that that is a great opportunity. As you get further down the line and you start thinking more of like, hey, I'm thinking of prototyping, that's where the door kind of opens up for you a little bit more, because you can leverage more opportunities. You can More people are open to using like FAR Part 35, which is for research and development. More people are open to talking about other transactions for prototyping or demonstration, depending on the agency that you're working with. You could use simplified acquisitions. You could get a purchase order in order for you to work and with them to help develop that prototype. It depends on what your budget is. And again, you can do all this at the same time. You can apply for SIBR phase two. You can apply for a sitter phase two. You can apply for an OT. You can apply for a grant. You can get venture capital funding. You're trying to get your product to the commercial market. That is your goal. That is the purpose of the SIBR and sitter program, is commercialization. And generally, that's the purpose of how government funds innovation. It's for the public good. There is an exception, of course, of doing any kind of developmental for specifically for government use. And that's where like you'll hear the stories of like how DARPA operates and what they're creating and how they're working with commercial firms. And usually there's kind of like a to simplify it again, like a spin-off that's a commercial version and a defense version. But as you go along the scale of that technology readiness level, as you get closer to the end of number nine, that's where if you're already commercial, then you can leverage FAR Part 12. You can, if you really want to get into it, you can start, you get really, really big, you can start supporting any kind of cost plus contracts, because now you're able to divide those costs very, very specifically. You know exactly how to sell it, you can price it out, you have enough people, your indirect rates are low enough, and you're able to deliver it at scale. There's a lot more, I would say, uncertainty in the beginning, a lot more certainty at the end. And so the door really opens up for you as you go along the scale of where you go from grant or and loans, SIBR, sitter, OTs, and then the FAR covers it all. It just you have to find people that are familiar with it.
So
I need a visual graphic for
you
this because I
do.
feel like I'm doing a lot of hand motions.
Yeah, absolutely. Graphic would be great. Out of curiosity, how do FFRDCs fit into this?
So they fit into it, I would say, probably more in the research and development and prototyping stage, and true prototyping. And what I mean by that is you're really trying to develop something from an idea, not just you're like modifying something. The government likes to see something to be truly unique. And they usually come in as like a trusted partner. Sometimes they're the prime and they bring in the small business in, or they're the lead on the team, depending on what kind of instrument you're using, and they're able to leverage it that way. But they play a really big role. You just have to find one that fits within the technology area that you're in. AI is very saturated right now, so you have to be able to solve a very unique problem in order for you to be able to work with a lot of these partners.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And just so everybody knows, FFRDC, it's a federally funded research and development center. Those are contracts that the government gives out to private industry to essentially administer R&D budgets. Is that right?
Yeah, and usually you also see a lot of partnership intermediaries as working in those types of relationships as well to help get the like ideas to the forefront to the government.
What's an example of a successful FFRDC?
Oh man, you just put me on the spot. Successful FFRDC. I'll have to phone a friend for that one for later. I'm trying to go down my list and be like, oh, okay, how do we define success? What does that mean?
From like I know that MITRE runs a bunch of them. I think JPL is another one out in California, all about propulsion and like I think it's the Jet Propulsion Lab is what it stands for. I don't remember. And I know like IDA is a big one here in or a medium-sized one here in the Northern Virginia area, all around data and data analytics. So yeah, there's a bunch of them out there, which I do, yeah. And I know we didn't, I know you weren't prepared for that. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you that. It came
You
in.
threw a curveball. Yeah, I mean, the thing about a lot of them, though, I think it's hard for the public to know and to measure how they're going to work with them because they're so behind the scenes. I mean, they all have websites, they all have great information. It's not very evident on how like a company can come in and say like, hey, I have this really cool technology, how can we work together? And I will say with any relationship, a lot of these small businesses are nervous because they don't want to lose their IP or intellectual property. They don't want to lose the right to their intellectual property. So MITRE does a really good job. I know a few people from MITRE, and I will say when I was starting out, I was very intimidated by them. Like the entire organization, I was like, they would never want to talk to me. And then I talked to a few people from there. I was like, oh, they're like really nice. But when you go to conferences and you see a lot of the folks there, it is very intimidating because they're very, very smart folks. So you're expecting for them not to be as down to earth as they are, but they're there to be a door that you can use, and that should be able to open up the opportunity for you to work with the government or at least get smarter on how to.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I know that they're like I know they have a lot of really smart people like I that work for them. I remember a conversation. I was a friend of mine called me looking for something high, like somebody that had a hyper specific skill set and a hyper specific knowledge set. And I ended up talking to somebody who's in the healthcare space, and I'm talking to somebody from MITRE who is an MD and also a data scientist. And it's like, man, like that's a bit of overachieving. I don't need, like you get your MD, you go back to school for a PhD in data. Come on now. But that's the kind of people they have there. It's a fascinating organization. And so how, can you explain the different phases of the SBIR Insider program and kind of walk us through what that looks like, and then also just again just give a base understanding to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll do it as the policy directive from SBA or Small Business Administration lays it out. Each agency that uses it slightly different, but the But the framework's the same and slightly different. I mean, it's usually the dollars that are associated with each one. So phase one is supposed to be like proof of concept. Generally, with a phase one, your deliverable is just, hey, is it feasible? Is there feasibility in this? It's a report. That's what you're delivering at the end of a phase one. So you're just trying to show to the government, like, hey, I have this idea. It looks like it's going to work. Generally, companies are doing a lot of discovery calls. They're trying to figure out, hey, what else do I need to know? It's low dollar value. There's no shame in the game of having to do multiple phase ones for you to really get an understanding. Is this a feasible idea? The key is you have to be careful to make sure that you're just not repeatedly getting phase ones, that you're actually advancing because the government wants to see you advance. But those are conversations you're going to have with your government client. Now, a phase one with like Department of Defense may be very different in the feasibility results than it might be with like Department or NSF, right? Their seed fund might be very different because Department of Defense is different. They're just always going to be different. So for you to be able to see, hey, can I actually bring this idea forward? Phase two, think of that as like you're prototyping or further developing this idea to show that you can actually make it into something. This is where you'll see there's also a program within CBRSITR where you can get additional funding for that phase two. Department of Defense calls it TAC-5, STRAT-5 funding, but it's in the SBA policy directive that every agency can offer this. So if you get private funding from someone else, the government can match it. You have to apply for it, write a proposal, but you can kind of build on that phase two to continue developing this technology. Phase three, I would say, is kind of like the outlier in all the phases because you don't have to go linearly. Phase three, you can go phase one to phase three. Like maybe you got a ton of money and now you need a phase three to go forth and prosper and go to commercialization. Phase three does not use any CBRSITR funds. So it would have to be outside of, it would have to be within the normal government fiscal year budget. It doesn't get to benefit off the CBRSITR funds. Phase three does not have any dollar limit because it is not associated with CBRSITR. And that really is to get you to the last stage, like to say, like, here's my final product. I'm going to commercialization. Now, the one thing that I will say is not every company needs a phase three. Some companies will get a phase two, they'll get a huge investor in, and they can go to commercialization off of that. And that's a success. That to me is still a success from the CBRSITR program. The phase three does not define the success. But those are the three phases. It's the same thing for sitters. Phase one, phase two, phase three works exactly the same way. The other big benefit of the CBRSITR program that I have to throw out there, or else I'll get my hand slapped if I don't say it, is it has really great intellectual property rights. They follow you, so keep taking advantage of them because it gives the company a lot of credit for the work that they're doing. So don't give those up. That should be your starting point if you do have a CBRSITR. So that is a huge benefit of the program as well.
That is a huge benefit. And so two questions. First, you mentioned the phase ones are low dollar. Is that, I think, is that still a $250,000 cap? Or is that,
It depends on
okay.
the agency. So I've seen where, like for example, NSF for phase ones has gone a lot higher. But I think it's also because it depends on like how much research it's actually going to take. They treat it as like a grant system, so they increase it. DoD is pretty good at like capping at like 50K usually, so it's very low. But depending on how they want to leverage it and who they want to enter, or what budget they have, they can get it up there. It just depends on what money they have.
Right. Absolutely. And then if you do need to move to a phase three, does the sponsoring office from the phase two, do they have to be the ones to pick you up?
No, it can be anyone. Anyone can pick you up. Once you have a SIBR, you kind of have just like a calling card for people. You've met competition standards, so you can go get a contract to further develop it from somebody else. It does not, you do not have to go like Air Force to Air Force. You could go Air Force to IRS. IRS could fund the phase three if they wanted to. If they had the money, right? And you guys have been in the conversation. That SIBR and SITR gives you a lot of advantage as a small business to be able to leverage it and to say, hey, I've met competition standards. I have this calling card now. I have a proven proof of concept. There's even opportunities where I know it kind of sucks for some companies where you get selected but not funded. Which means again, like government thought it was really cool, but they ran out of money when they got to you. So you don't get any money, but now you have to find someone that has the money and that can pick it up. People don't spend enough time, I think, finding opportunities for that. I think mostly because it kind of breaks your spirits to know, like, oh, I think you're cool, but not cool enough is how it comes off to a lot of folks. But even opportunities like that, you could take that and you can turn that into something where you can get a contract with another agency for that idea to bring that to a prototype or phase three.
Okay. No, that's fantastic. What about OTAs? How do OTAs work? How do they differ from SIBR and SITR? And from farm-based contracts?
All right, so, here we go.
Yeah.
Other transactions are really, really awesome because the benefit of them and the reason why they exist is to help companies that don't necessarily know how to do business with the government and don't want all the strings attached of doing business with the government to bring their ideas or get funded by the government to the government. So the history of OTs or the legend of OTs, it started with NASA during this, for the Space Act is the first instance that we saw a mention of other transactions. And NASA really, I would say, uses it. They have the shortest authority. They also use it the most broadly because it just says use other transactions. There's that whole statute that you have for Department of Defense, they don't have. They have this blurb. That's it. That's all that exists. Most agencies, what they use it for is they generally call it research and development or research and demonstration. Department of Defense, because they're special, they have their statute that they use that's very prescriptive. It describes, they have one statute for research and development, one statute for prototyping, and it also includes what's called a follow-on. That's what people are most familiar with. The way other transactions work is they're not, for some agencies, they're not just for innovation. They could be used for leases. They could be used for anything that it makes sense for them to use it for. That is literally like they have a very broad authority. Other agencies have made sure that they put confines around it to say, hey, you can use it. Like NIH is very specific. They're like, you can only use this statute to study blood and lung cancer. That's it. And
Interesting.
anything associated with it is within the statute. Department of Defense said, well, now there's a long history of how we got here, but Department of Defense said, in order to support the Department of Defense mission, you can use these authorities to develop your technology. And then if you're successful, you can also use what's called follow-on, which can be FAR-based or non-FAR-based. The way companies will use OTs is there's or the government may they may decide what competition makes sense. So they would do their market research. If no other company is able to bring this forth, they can go and they can work with that company direct. They would put in their file that, hey, we did our market research. This authority made the most sense. There's no one else that does it, so we're going to work with this company. There's no like sole source. Sole source is a FAR term. So FAR does not apply. That does not mean that OTs are not do not have any laws regulating them. You still have to follow laws. There's still several things that apply, like NIST still applies. A lot of people are surprised by that. And I always have to say it's not CMMC, it's the NIST 800-171 that applies, not CMMC. The other one is CECA does not apply to OTs, because if you look at the nature of it, you're looking at research, you're looking at technology, you're looking at ideas that people are bringing that are not necessarily going to be available worldwide. And the example that I use, like in classes, is there's not very many Dr. Neil deGrasse Tysons out there. And so most likely he would be a very great candidate for an OT without competition, because he's going to bring a lot of ideas forth. The other thing is, like, it gives you flexibility to build teams, and you're able to not work. You don't have to work in the prime sub relationship that a lot of people think of. It's no longer a cooperative type of arrangement that you would see with the FAR. You're leaning more towards a collaborative approach as much as possible when it comes to OTs. To really simplify it for everyone, the beauty of OTs is you get to work with the government how you would in the commercial sector. You get to negotiate all the terms. You get to look at the agreement. You get to negotiate how you want to structure it. If there is a change, like let's say your milestones changes and your prototype isn't going the way you want it to go, you and the government can get on the phone and you can say, "Hey, I don't think these milestones make sense anymore. Can we adjust them? I think that's actually going to increase our cost or decrease our cost. We'll probably have to think of how to restructure this agreement," and the government is willing to do it.
Fantastic.
So it allows for a ton of flexibility. You just have to know what the statute for that specific agency says so that you could leverage it appropriately for what you're doing. There's not an end goal, like with sib or sitter, to go to commercialization with OTs. The goal is just to get that thing that you need, and be able to fund that.
What are some examples of some successful, some successful projects that have been developed utilizing this?
Utilizing OTs or sib or sitter or
OT.
both?
OTs.
OTs. So DARPA actually has a ton that they've posted. I would say the biggest one that most people are familiar with is the COVID vaccine. That was funded largely by OTs, dating all the way back to the early 2000s, so from the initial research. And it was across the entire federal landscape. It wasn't just HHS. You had NSF involved, you had DOD involved, you had Department of Commerce involved, and there was billions of dollars that went into that research and into getting you the vaccines that we were able to receive in 2020. That to me, I think, is the most vast example that you have. You also have the example of a lot of the satellites that we have. They were funded by OTs. During the Space Act, a lot of the stuff that NASA did was OTs. They leased buildings, they got people in, scientists in, they contracted out with them through OTs. So the possibilities are endless. The success stories that DARPA, you can actually go on DARPA's website. You can look at the contracts that they've done and the research that they've done that they're able to publish. And they'll have them on there and describe the projects for you. NSF also reports on them as well. Another successful OT that I know you're going to ask me about later is the Tradewind Solutions Marketplace. That was an OT. That was a concept that was brought forth. Yeah, it was a model. So that's a really great example that a lot of people are familiar with. One day they'll be as familiar with it as the COVID vaccine, but
Not yet.
we'll get
Not
there.
yet. We're early days. Early days.
We're in
So what it you I mean, you know, you brought that up. That was where I was getting ready to go. What it, can you explain what it is to people, what problem it's trying to solve, and why the government decided to spin up this new this essentially new avenue, right?
Yeah, so Tradewind Solutions Marketplace, it is new. It's only been around since November of 2022. So it is brand spanking new for government. So it is an idea of having a marketplace that, instead of, reading the dreaded white papers that we're so familiar with in the government in this, especially in the innovation space, the idea is get rid of the white paper, have a 5-minute video. It's a 5-minute video that has to follow the rubric that's in the announcement. Companies submit to this video. It gets assessed the very next month. So if you submit today in February, in March, it'll be assessed by academic, industry, and government assessors. And then by the end of that month, by the end of March, you would know the results of whether you're awardable or not awardable. What that means is if you're awardable, you get into the marketplace. You have met competition standards. You're in the marketplace. The government can go into the marketplace only. Only government has access. They can do their market research in there. They can pull a video from the marketplace, say, I want this solution. And they can leverage any award instrument they want and work with that company and write them an award. You've met competition standards. So you can most of the time they award another transaction because it's everyone wants to be cool. They want an OT, so they're gonna write an OT.
Absolutely.
But we've had delivery orders, we've had traditional VAR-based contracts awarded off of the marketplace. So what the awardable status gives you is very similar to what we talked about for Sib or Sitter. It gives you a calling card to say, hey, you want to find me? Are you familiar with the Tradewind Solutions marketplace? So they go to the marketplace. What we've developed is a how do you buy off the marketplace guide, an acquisition guide. It's all on the website. And the big ethos for us is transparency. So we really try to make sure that we're helping people. We have a great feedback loop. So that being said, for the companies that are not awardable, because I know everyone's like, okay, well, what if I don't get in? What does that mean? That doesn't necessarily mean you should stop. That means that what you're going to get if you're deemed not awardable is a feedback from the assessors. So you'll get to see how you scored, you'll get a heat map, you'll get comments from the assessors. You'll get all that in a separate email. You'll be able to look over that, see what adjustments you need to make in the video. Then, if you have questions, what we have is called real people time or RPTs. Which are our office hours. So you can schedule time with us. We'll walk you through all of the feedback. We'll talk about what you can do better. If there's still like really like big questions of like, hey, why did the assessor say this or that? We'll go meet with the assessors. We'll talk to them. We'll say, hey, there's still questions. There seems to be some discrepancy here. Can you clarify what you were thinking? And then we work with that company to say like, okay, so here's the areas that we recommend you improve. They resubmit, they get reassessed, and usually after 2 to 3 times, people are successful. Some people are not successful. I think we've only had like 6 people that just didn't move on. And that's because they just weren't a good fit. Like we had someone that was, I think, like a water purification, didn't fit within the criteria of the solicitation. One was it was a technology, but for Tradewinds, it didn't fit within the strategic focus areas. But we did find them another opportunity that they could submit to, so they were able to go and submit. And since 2022, Tradewind Solutions Marketplace has grown. So we have what's called the Cyber Aisle, which is now part of the Solutions Marketplace, which is a place for potential phase threes. So we know that there's a problem set. We know that the government and Congress, phase threes are really important to them. So we're trying to collect people, everyone that has had or has a phase one or phase two to submit their information. It's all in the announcement. The video is slightly different from what is for the marketplace itself. We check it for compliance only. It doesn't go through assessment because you've already done competition. You've got the CBER. Your video goes into the marketplace of all the CBER aisles. And that way, if the government is looking, hey, I really like one of my goals is to do a CBER phase three, where do I find these companies? I'm going to find it here. And we're just one of the people trying to solve it. GSA is trying to solve that. Other agencies are trying to solve it for Congress. But this is just one idea. So we're testing that idea. We're testing CBER aisle to see
Interesting.
How viable it is. We also supported a CDAO CBER open topic at the end of last year. And so the idea was you don't write a technical, you submit a video. And so the video went to the marketplace submission portal. We used a similar rubric that we do to the marketplace. Now we're waiting for all the announcements to go out as a result of that. So it's an interesting model to get away from written form to a video submission, which has challenged some. I've heard it. It's very hard to get everything in 5 minutes, but we've had over 1,000 submissions. I think we have over 500 companies already in the marketplace. We've had several awards. I think we just posted last, no, December. I think in December we posted the year in review for 2024. So we've had a lot of successes off of it. We've also, I would say, challenged a lot of contract shops to really dig into the US code and dig into the FAR to make sure that they're getting all their paperwork together. But the people that have used it have liked it. It's a great market research because they've been able to get through all the noise of like people saying what they think they can do or vaporware. We know we hate that. And able to look at actual assessed technologies to make the best decision of what they're able to actually put on contract.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you're getting feedback in a timely fashion as well. That's super big, right? We both know that the government's not known for their speediness or their feedback. And so, being able to get feedback is absolutely huge. And have that interaction is fantastic. And I know that this was the first, but it's also spun up a couple of other agencies doing marketplaces like this, based on your model, correct?
So we have built now two others, which is Platform One has a marketplace supporting the Platform One mission and their strategic focus areas. And then we just kicked off DARPA ERIS, ERIS. So that is brand new. So anyone that's kind of on that like precipice of like really unique stuff, that's going to be a really good fit. And each of these marketplaces are unique to the focus areas for that specific marketplace. They use the same concept. They use a lot of the same expertise, like the team that supports it, is everyone that I work with very closely. So we've been leveraging this model now for three marketplaces. I'm excited to see what next year or this year, I guess, brings for it. But it has, I would say it has brought a lot of interest and has also been able to unlock possibilities for companies that are trying to create that, like, how do you find us map that may have, are still waiting on a CBER or maybe they're still waiting for like their one first win. So and they can point to something other than handing that pesky capability statement to the government. They're able to like show them something where they're explaining what they actually do.
It's fantastic. I love it. I love what you're doing. I love the innovation, especially as it, and I appreciate you coming on. Before we do wrap up, do you have any additional points? Anything we missed? Anything else you'd like to say to folks?
I would say my biggest piece of advice for people is create your contract pathway document for the government. A lot of people forget to do that because we're so focused on like showing the cool stuff that we're doing. But the government, sometimes they have narrow vision too on what the art of possibilities are. So if you're a small, non-traditional company, put that right out front. Tell them that you're in the marketplace. Tell them you have a CBER. Tell them what partners you work with. Maybe you have companies that have contract vehicles that you can be a subcontractor on. That way you can get the foot in the door. Don't think you have to have that one perfect contract. You can have 10 perfect contracts at the same time.
Absolutely.
So, don't stretch yourself too thin, but make sure that you're very tactful in how you're talking with the government. And use all the resources you have. There's a ton out there. There's a ton of experts that are willing to help. So get the partnerships, get that contract pathway document together. If you don't know what it is, I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has on LinkedIn about it.
Absolutely.
But the art of possibilities are all out there. It's just a matter of you having to know how to leverage it and leverage it to your ability.
Awesome. Really appreciate you coming on Robots of Red Tape. It's been super fun having you.
Yeah,
And
thank you so much.
thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hope you're having a great day.